and often, in pointing out something, she would begin crying. There was no question in my mind that the tears were real and that she was deeply affected by what had happened in this place. I couldn't help contrasting Linda with Susan. When they reached the house, Linda said, Tex sent her around the back to look for an unlocked window or door. She reported that everything was locked, though she hadn't actually checked. This explained why they ignored the open nursery window. Tex then slit a screen on one of the front windows with a knife. Though the actual screen had since been replaced, Linda pointed to the correct window. She also said the slash was horizontal as it had been. Tex then told her to go back and wait by the car in the driveway. Linda did as she was told. Perhaps a minute or two later, Katie came back and asked Linda for her knife. This was the knife with the taped handle, and told her, listen for sounds. A few minutes later, Linda heard horrifying sounds coming from the house. A man moaned, no, 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 then screamed very loudly. The scream, which seemed continuous, was punctuated with other voices, male and female, begging and pleading for their lives. Wanting to stop what was happening, Linda said, I started running toward the house. As she reached the walk, there was a man, a tall man, just coming out of the door, staggering, and he had blood all over his face, and he was standing by a post, and we looked into each other's eyes for a minute, I don't know however long, and I said, oh God, I'm so sorry. And then he just fell into the bushes. And then Sadie came running out of the house, and I said, Sadie, please make it stop. People are coming. Which wasn't true, but I wanted to make it stop. And she said, it's too late. Complaining that she had lost her knife, Susan ran back into the house. Linda remained outside. Susan had earlier told me and the grand jury that Linda had never entered the residence. Turning, Linda saw a dark-haired woman in a white gown running across the lawn. Katie was pursuing her, an upraised knife in her hand. Somehow the tall man managed to stagger from the bushes next to the porch onto the lawn, where he had again fallen. Linda saw Tex hit him over the head with something. It could have been a gun, but she wasn't sure, then stab him repeatedly in the back as he lay on the ground. Shown a number of photographs, Linda identified the tall man as Wojtek Frykowski, the dark-haired woman as Abigail Folger. Examining the autopsy report on Frykowski, I found that 5 of his 51 stab wounds were to the back. Linda turned and ran down the driveway. For what seemed like maybe 5 minutes, she hid in the bushes near the gate, then climbed the fence again and ran down Cielo to where they had parked the Ford. Question. Why didn't you run to one of the houses and call the police? I asked Linda. Answer? My first thought was get help. Then my little girl entered my mind. She was back at the ranch with Charlie. I didn't know where I was or how to get out of there. She got in the car and had started the engine when all of a sudden they were there. They were covered with blood. They looked like zombies. Tex yelled at me to turn off the car and get over. He had a terrible look in his eyes. Linda slid over to the passenger side. Then he started in on Sadie and yelled at her for losing her knife. Tex had put the .22 revolver on the seat between them. Linda noticed that the grip was broken, and Tex told her it had smashed when he hit the man over the head. Sadie and Katie complained that their heads hurt because the people had pulled their hair while they were fighting with them. Sadie also said the big man had hit her over the head and that the girl, it was unclear whether she meant Sharon or Abigail, had cried for her mother. Katie also complained that her hand hurt, explaining that when she stabbed, she kept hitting bones, and since the knife didn't have a regular handle, it bruised her hand. Question. How did you feel, Linda? Answer. In a state of shock. Question. What about the others? How did they act? Answer, as if it was all a game. Tex, Sadie, and Katie changed their clothing while the car was in motion, Linda holding the wheel for Tex. Linda herself didn't change since there was no blood on her. Tex told them he wanted to find a place to hose the blood off, and he turned off Benedict Canyon onto a short street not too far from the Tate residence. Linda's account of the hosing incident paralleled Susan Atkins and Rudolph Weber's. Weber's house was located 1.8 miles from the Tate premises. From there, Tex turned onto Benedict Canyon again and drove along through a dark, hilly country area. He stopped the car on a dirt shoulder off the road, and Tex, Sadie, and Katie gave Linda their bloody clothing, which, on Tex's instructions, she rolled up in one bundle and threw down the slope. Since it was dark, she couldn't see where it landed. After driving off, Tex told Linda to wipe the knives clean of fingerprints, then throw them out the window. She did, the first knife hitting a bush at the side of the road, the second, which she tossed out a few seconds later, striking the curb and bouncing back into the road. Looking back, she saw it lying there. Linda believed she threw the gun out a few minutes later, but she wasn't sure. It was possible that Tex did it. After driving for a time, they stopped at a gas station. Linda was unable to recall the street, where Katie and Sadie took turns going into the restroom to wash the rest of the blood off their bodies. Then they drove back to Spawn Ranch. Linda did not have a watch, but guessed it must have been about 2 a.m. Charles Manson was standing on the boardwalk in the same spot where he had been when they drove off. Sadie said she saw some blood on the outside of the car, and Manson had the girls get rags and sponges and wash the car inside and out. He then told them to go to the bunkhouse. Brenda and Clem were already there. Manson asked Tex how it had gone. Tex told him that there was a lot of panic, that it was real messy, and that there were bodies lying all over the place, but that everyone was dead. Manson asked the four, "Do you have any remorse?" All shook their heads and said no. Linda did feel remorse, she told me, but she didn't admit it to Charlie because I was afraid for my life. I could see in his eyes he knew how I felt, and it was against his way. Manson told them, "Go to bed and say nothing to the others." Linda slept most of the day. It was almost sundown when Sadie told her to go into the trailer, that the TV news was coming on. Although Linda could not recall seeing Tex, she remembered Sadie, Katie, Barbara Hoyt, and Clem being there. It was the big news. For the first time, Linda heard the names of the victims. She also learned that one, Sharon Tate, had been pregnant. Only a few days earlier, Linda had learned that she herself was pregnant. "As we were watching the news," Linda said, "in my head I kept saying, why would they do such a thing?" After Linda and I left the Tate residence, I asked her to show us the route they had taken. She found the dirt shoulder where they had pulled off to dispose of the clothing, but was unable to find the street where Tex had turned off Benedict Canyon, so I had the sheriff's deputy who was driving take us directly to Portola. Once on the street, Linda immediately identified 9870, pointing to the hose in front. Number 9870 was Rudolph Weber's house. She also pointed to the spot where they had parked the car. It was the same spot Weber had indicated. Neither his address nor even the fact that he had been located had appeared in the press. We were back on Benedict looking for the area where Linda had thrown out the knives when one of the deputies said, "We've got company." Looking out the window, we saw we were being followed by a Channel 2 TV unit. Its presence in the area may have been a coincidence, but I doubted it. More likely, someone at the jail or in the courts had alerted the press that we were taking Linda out. At this time, only a few people knew that Linda Kasabian would be a witness for the prosecution. I'd hoped to keep this secret as long as possible. I'd also hoped to take Linda to the LaBianca residence and several other sites, but now that would have to wait. Telling Linda to turn her head away so she wouldn't be recognized, I asked the driver to hightail it back to Sybil Brand. Once on the freeway, we tried to outrun the TV unit, but without success. They filmed us all the way. It was like a Max Sennett comedy, only with the press in pursuit of the fuzz. After Linda was back in jail, I asked Sergeant McGann to get some cadets from the police academy or a troop of Boy Scouts and conduct a search for the knives. From Linda's testimony, we knew that they had probably been thrown out of the car somewhere between the clothing site and the hill where young Stephen Weiss had found the gun, an area of less than 2 miles. We also knew that since Linda had looked back and seen one of the knives lying in the road, there must have been some illumination nearby, which could be another clue. The following day, March 4th, Gypsy made another visit to Fleischman's office. She told him, in the presence of his law partner Ronald Goldman, if Linda testifies, 30 people are going to do something about it. I'd already checked out the security at Sybil Brand. Until her baby was born, Linda was being kept in an isolation cell off the infirmary. She had no contact with the other inmates. Deputies brought her meals. After the baby was born, however, she would be reassigned to one of the open dormitories where she might be threatened, even killed by Sadie, Katie, or Leslie. I made a note to talk to Captain Carpenter to see if other arrangements could be made. Attorney Richard Caballero had been able to postpone the inevitable, but he couldn't prevent it. The meeting between Susan Atkins and Charles Manson took place in the Los Angeles County Jail on March 5th. Caballero, who was present, would later testify. One of the first things they wanted to know was whether either one had gotten to see Linda Kasabian yet. Neither having done so, it was decided both should keep trying. Manson asked Susan, "Are you afraid of the gas chamber?" Susan grinned and replied that she wasn't. With that, Caballero must have realized that he had lost her. Susan and Charlie talked for an hour or so more, but Caballero hadn't the foggiest idea of what they said. At some point in the conversation, they began to talk in sort of a double talk or pig Latin, and when they reached that point, they lost me. However, the looks they exchanged said it all. It was like a joyous homecoming. Sadie Mae Glutz had returned to the irresistible Charles Manson. She fired Caballero the next day. On March 6th, Manson appeared in court and argued a number of novel motions. One asked that the deputy district attorneys in charge of the trial be incarcerated for a period of time under the same circumstances that I have been subject to. Another requested that he be free to travel to any place I should deem fit in preparing my defense. There were more, and Judge Keene declared himself appalled at Manson's outlandish requests. Keene then said he had reviewed the entire file on the case, from his nonsensical motions to his numerous violations of the gag order. He had also discussed Manson's conduct with Judges Lucas and Dell, before whom Manson had also appeared, concluding that it had become abundantly clear to me that you are incapable of acting as your own attorney. Infuriated, Manson shouted, "It's not me that's on trial here as much as this court is on trial." He also told the judge, "Go wash your hands. They're dirty." The court, "Mr. Manson, your status at this time of acting as your own attorney is now vacated." Against Manson's strong objections, Keene appointed Charles Hollopeter, a former president of the Los Angeles Criminal Courts Bar, as Manson's attorney of record. "You can kill me," Manson said, "but you can't give me an attorney. I won't take one." Keene told Manson that if he found an attorney of his own choosing, he would consider a motion to substitute him for Hollopeter. I knew Hollopeter by reputation. Since he'd never been Charlie's bootlicker, I guessed he'd last about a month. I was too generous. Toward the end of the proceedings, Manson shouted, "There is no God in this courtroom." As if on cue, a number of family members jumped up and yelled at Keene, "You are a mockery of justice. You are a joke." The judge found 3 of them, Gypsy, Sandy, and Mark Ross, in contempt, and sentenced each to 5 days in the county jail. When Sandy was searched prior to being booked, among the items found in her purse was a buck knife. After this, the sheriff's deputies, who were in charge of maintaining security in the Los Angeles criminal courts, began searching all spectators before they entered the courtroom. On March 7th, Linda Kasabian was taken to the hospital. 2 days later, she gave birth to a boy, whom she named Angel. On the 13th, she was returned to the jail without the child, Linda's mother having taken him back to New Hampshire. In the interim, I had talked to Captain Carpenter, and he had agreed to let Linda remain in her former cell just off the infirmary. I checked it out myself. It was a small room, its furnishings consisting of a bed, toilet bowl, wash basin, and a small desk and chair. It was clean, but bleak. Far more important, it was safe. Every few days, I called McGann. No, he hadn't got around to looking for the knives yet. On March 11th, Susan Atkins, after formally requesting that Richard Caballero be relieved as her attorney, asked for Day Shin in Caballero's place. Inasmuch as Shin, one of the first attorneys to call on Manson after he was brought down from Independence, had represented Manson on several matters and had visited him more than 40 times, Judge Keene felt there might be a possible conflict of interest involved. Shin denied this. Keene then warned Susan of the possible dangers of being represented by an attorney who had been so closely involved with one of her co-defendants. Susan said she didn't care. She wanted Shin. Keene granted the substitution. I hadn't come up against Shin before. He was about 40, Korean-born. According to the press, his main practice, before allying himself with the Manson defense, had been obtaining Mexican domestics for Southern California families. On leaving the courtroom, Shin told waiting reporters that Susan Atkins definitely will deny everything she told the grand jury. On March 15th, we took Linda Kasabian out again. Only this time we used not a conspicuous sheriff's van, but unmarked police cars. I wanted Linda to trace the route the killers had taken the night the LaBiancas were killed. After dinner that night, Saturday, August 9th, 1969, Linda and several other family members were standing outside the kitchen at Spawn. Manson called Linda, Katie, and Leslie aside and told them to get a change of clothing and meet him in the bunkhouse. This time he mentioned nothing to Linda about knives, but he did tell her again to get her driver's license. I just looked at him and, you know, just sort of pleaded with my eyes, please don't make me go. Because, Linda said, I just knew we were going out again, and I knew it would be the same thing. But I was afraid to say anything. Last night was too messy, Manson told the group when they assembled in the bunkhouse. This time I'm going to show you how to do it. Tex complained that the weapons they had used the previous night weren't effective enough. Linda saw two swords in the bunkhouse, one of which was the straight Satan's sword. She did not see anyone pick them up, but later she noticed the Satan's sword and two smaller knives under the front seat of the car. In questioning DiCarlo, I'd learned that one night about this time, he'd noticed that the sword had been taken out. Again, the group piled into Swartz's Ford. This time, Manson himself slipped into the driver's seat, with Linda next to him, Clem on the passenger side, Tex, Sadie, Katie, and Leslie crowded in back. All wore dark clothing, Linda said, except for Clem, who had on an olive drab field jacket. As he often did, Manson wore a leather thong around his neck, the two ends extending down to his breastbone, where they were looped together. I asked Linda if anyone else was wearing such a thong. She said no. Before they left, Manson asked Bruce Davis for some money. Just as DiCarlo took care of the family guns, Davis acted as comptroller for the group, taking care of the stolen credit cards, fake ID, and so forth. As they drove off, Manson told them that tonight they would divide into two groups. Each would take a separate house. He said he'd drop off one group, then take the second group with him. When they stopped to buy gas, using cash, not a credit card, Manson told Linda to take over the driving. Questioning Linda, I established that Manson, and Manson alone, gave all the instructions as to where they were to go and what they were to do. At no time, she said, did Tex Watson instruct anyone to do anything. Charlie was in complete command. Following Manson's directions, Linda took the freeway to Pasadena. Once off it, he gave her so many directions she was unsure where they were. Eventually, he told her to stop in front of a house, which Linda described as a modern, one-story, middle-class-type home. This was the place where, as described by Susan Atkins, Manson got out, had them drive around the block, then got back in, telling them that, having looked in the window and seen photographs of children, he didn't want to do that particular house, though he added, in the future it might be necessary to kill children also. Linda's account was essentially the same as Susan's. After riding around Pasadena for some time, Manson again took over the driving. Linda, I remember we started driving up a hill with lots of houses, nice houses, rich houses, and trees. We got to the top of the hill and turned around and stopped in front of a certain house. Linda couldn't remember if it was one story or two, only that it was big. Manson, however, said the houses were too close together here, so they drove off. Shortly after this, Manson spotted a church. Pulling into the parking lot next to it, he again got out. Linda believed, but wasn't absolutely sure, that he told them he was going to get the minister or priest. However, he returned a few minutes later, saying the church door was locked. Susan Atkins had neglected to mention the church in her account. I learned of it for the first time from Linda Kasabian. Manson again told Linda to drive, but the route he gave her was so confusing that she soon became lost. Later, driving up Sunset from the ocean, there occurred another incident which Susan Atkins had neglected to mention. Observing a white sports car ahead of him, Manson told Linda, "At the next red light, pull up beside it. I'm going to kill the driver." Linda pulled up next to the car, but just as Manson jumped out, the light changed to green, and the sports car zoomed away. Another potential victim, unaware to this day how close to death he had come. Thus far, their wanderings appeared totally at random, Manson seemingly having no particular victims in mind. As I'd later argue to the jury, up to this time no one in the vast, sprawling metropolis of 7 million people, whether in a home, a church, or even a car, was safe from Manson's insatiable lust for death, blood, and murder. But after the sports car incident, Manson's directions became very specific. He directed Linda to the Los Feliz section of Los Angeles, not far from Griffith Park, having her stop on the street in front of a home in a residential area. Linda recognized the house. In June of 1968, she and her husband had been driving from Seattle to Taos when they stopped off in Los Angeles. A friend had taken them to the house, 3267 Waverly Drive, for a peyote party. One of the men who were living there, she recalled, was named Harold. In another of the many coincidences which abounded in this case, Linda had also been to the Harold True residence, though at a time none of the family members were there. Linda asked, "Charlie, you're not going to do that house, are you?" Manson replied, "No, the one next door." Telling the others to stay in the car, Manson got out. Linda noticed him shove something into his belt, but she couldn't see what it was. She watched him walking up the driveway until it curved, and he disappeared from sight. I presumed, although I couldn't be sure of this, that Manson had a gun. For Rosemary and Lino LaBianca, the horror that would end in their deaths had begun. Linda guessed the time was about 2 a.m. Some 10 minutes later, she said, Manson returned to the car. I asked Linda if he was still wearing the leather thong around his neck. She said she hadn't noticed, though she did notice later that night that he no longer had it. I showed her the leather thong used to bind the wrists of Lino LaBianca, and she said it was the same kind Manson had been wearing. Manson told Tex, Katie, and Leslie to get out of the car and bring their clothing bundles with them. Obviously, they were to be the first team. Linda heard some, though not all, of the conversation. Manson told the trio that there were two people inside the house, that he had tied them up and told them that everything was going to be all right and that they shouldn't be afraid. He also instructed Tex, Katie, and Leslie that they were not to cause fear and panic in the people, as had happened the night before. The LaBiancas had been creepy-crawled, pacified with Charles Manson's unctuous assurances, then set up to be slaughtered. Linda heard only bits and pieces of the rest of the conversation. She did not hear Manson specifically order the three to kill the two persons, nor did she see them carrying any weapons. She believed she heard Manson say, "Don't let them know you were going to kill them." And she definitely heard him instruct them that when they were done, they were to hitchhike back to the ranch. As the trio started toward the house, Manson got back in the car and handed Linda a woman's wallet, telling her to wipe off the prints and remove the change. In opening it, she noticed the driver's license, which had a photo of a woman with dark hair. She recalled the woman's first name was Rosemary, while the last name was either Mexican or Italian. She also remembered seeing a number of credit cards and a wristwatch. When I asked Linda the color of the wallet, she said it was red. Actually, it was brown. She also claimed to have removed all the change, but when the wallet was found, there were still some coins in one of the inner compartments. Both were understandable errors, I felt, particularly overlooking the extra change compartment. Manson again took over the driving. Linda was now on the passenger side, Susan and Clem in back. Manson told Linda that when they reached a predominantly colored area, he wanted her to toss the wallet out onto a sidewalk so a black person would find it, use the credit cards, and be arrested. This would make people think the Panthers had committed the murders, he explained. Manson drove onto the freeway not far from where they had dropped off Tex, Katie, and Leslie. After driving for a long time, he pulled off the freeway and stopped at a nearby service station. Apparently having changed his plans, Manson now told Linda to put the wallet in the women's restroom. Linda did, only she hid it too well, lifting the top of the toilet tank and placing it over the bulb where it would remain undiscovered for 4 months. I asked Linda if she could remember anything distinctive about the station. She remembered there was a restaurant next door and that it seemed to radiate the color orange. There was a Denny's restaurant next to the Standard Station in Sylmar, with a large orange sign. When Linda was in the restroom, Manson went to the restaurant, returning with 4 milkshakes. Probably at the same time the LaBiancas were being murdered, the man who had ordered their deaths was sipping a milkshake. Again Manson had Linda drive. After a long time, perhaps an hour, they reached the beach somewhere south of Venice. Linda recalled seeing some oil storage tanks. All four got out of the car, Sadie and Clem, at Charlie's instructions, dropping behind while he and Linda walked ahead in the sand. Suddenly Manson was again all love. It was as if the events of the last 48 hours had never happened. Linda told Charlie that she was pregnant. Manson took Linda's hand, and as she described it, "It was sort of nice, you know. We were just talking. I gave him some peanuts, and he just sort of made me forget about everything. Made me feel good." Would the jury understand this? I thought so, once they understood Manson's charismatic personality and Linda's love for him. Just as they reached a side street, a police car pulled up, and 2 officers got out. They asked the pair what they were doing. Charlie replied, "We were just going for a walk." Then, as if they should recognize him, he asked, "Don't you know who I am? Or don't you remember my name?" They said, "No," then returned to the patrol car and drove off, without asking either for identification. It was, Linda said, a friendly conversation, lasting only a minute. Finding the 2 officers on duty in the area that night should be fairly easy, I thought, unaware how wrong I could be. Clem and Sadie were already back in the car when they returned. Manson then told Linda to drive to Venice. En route, he asked the 3 if they knew anyone there. None did. Manson then asked Linda, What about the man you and Sandy met in Venice? Wasn't he a piggy? Linda replied, Yes, he's an actor. Manson told her to drive to his apartment. I asked Linda about the actor. One afternoon in early August, Linda said, she and Sandy had been hitchhiking near the pier when this man picked them up. He told them he was Israeli or Arab, Linda couldn't recall which, and that he had appeared in a movie about Khalil Gibran. The two girls were hungry, and he drove them to his apartment and fixed them lunch. Afterwards, Sandy napped, and Linda and the man made love. Before the girls left, he gave them some food and spare clothing. Linda couldn't remember the man's name, only that it was foreign. However, she felt sure she could find the apartment house, as she had located it when Manson asked her to drive there that night. When they pulled up in front, Manson asked Linda if the man would let her in. I think so, she replied. What about Sadie and Clem? Linda said she guessed so. Manson then handed her a pocket knife and demonstrated how he wanted her to slit the actor's throat. Linda said she couldn't do it. I'm not you, Charlie, Linda told Manson. I can't kill anybody. Manson asked her to take him to the man's apartment. Linda led Charlie up the stairs, but deliberately pointed to the wrong door. On returning to the car, Manson gave the trio explicit instructions. They were to go to the actor's apartment. Linda was to knock. When the man let her in, Sadie and Clem were to go in also. Once they were inside, Linda was to slit the man's throat, and Clem was to shoot him. When finished, they were to hitchhike back to the ranch. Linda saw Manson hand Clem a gun, but was unable to describe it, nor did she know if Sadie also had a knife. If anything goes wrong, Manson told them, just hang it up. Don't do it. He then slid into the driver's seat and drove off. Like the church and sports car incidents, Susan Atkins had not mentioned the Venice incident to me, nor had she said anything about it when testifying before the grand jury. While I felt that she might have forgotten the two earlier incidents, I suspected the third was omitted intentionally, since it directly involved her as a willing partner in still another attempted murder. It was possible, however, that had I had more time to interview Susan, this too might have come out. The actor's apartment was on the top or fifth floor, but Linda did not tell Clem or Sadie this. Instead, on reaching the fourth floor, she knocked on the first door she saw. Eventually, a man sleepily asked, "Who is it?" She replied, "Linda." When the man opened the door a crack, Linda said, "Oh, excuse me, I have the wrong apartment." The door was only open a second or two, and Linda caught just a glimpse of the man. She had the impression, though she was unsure of this, that he was middle-aged. The three then left the building, but not before Sadie, ever the animal, defecated on the landing. It was obvious that Linda Kasabian had prevented still another Manson-ordered murder. As independent evidence corroborating her story, it was important that we locate not only the actor, but the man who answered the door. Perhaps he'd remember being awakened at 4 or 5 a.m. by a pretty young girl. From the apartment house, Clem, Sadie, and Linda walked to the beach, a short distance away. Clem wanted to ditch the gun. He disappeared from sight behind a sand pile near a fence. Linda presumed that he had either buried the gun or tossed it over the fence. Walking back to the Pacific Coast Highway, they hitched a ride to the entrance of Topanga Canyon. There was a hippie crash pad nearby, next door to the Malibu feed bin, and Sadie said she knew a girl who was staying there. Linda recalled there was also an older man there and a big dog. The three stayed about an hour, smoking some weed, then left. They then hitched two rides, the last taking them all the way to the entrance of Santa Susana Pass Road, where Clem and Linda got out. Sadie, Linda learned the next day, remained in the car until it reached the waterfall area. When Linda and Clem arrived at the ranch, Tex and Leslie were already there, asleep in one of the rooms. She didn't see Katie, though she learned the next day that, like Sadie, she had gone on to the camp by the waterfall. Linda went to bed in the saloon. 2 days later, Linda Kasabian fled Spawn Ranch. The manner of her departure, however, would cause the prosecution a great deal of concern. Rather than taking Linda directly to the La Bianca residence, I had the sheriff's deputy drive to the Los Feliz area to see if Linda could find the house itself. She did, pointing out both the La Bianca and True houses, the place where they had parked, the driveway up which Manson had walked, and so on. I also wanted to find the two houses in Pasadena where Manson had stopped earlier that night, but though we spent hours looking for them, we were at this time unsuccessful. Linda did find the apartment house where the actor had lived, 1101 Oceanfront Walk, and pointed out both his apartment, 501, and the door on which she had knocked, 403. I asked Patchett and Gutierrez to locate and interview both the actor and the man who had been living in 403. Linda also showed us the sand pile near the fence where she believed Clem had disposed of the gun, but though we got out shovels and dug up the area, we were unable to locate the weapon. It was possible that someone had already found it, or that Clem or one of the other family members had reclaimed it later. We never did learn what type of gun it was. Having been out since early in the morning, we stopped at a Chinese restaurant for lunch. That afternoon, we returned to Pasadena and must have driven past 40 churches before Linda found the one where Manson had stopped. I asked LAPD to photograph it and the adjoining parking lot as a trial exhibit. Linda also identified the Standard station in Sylmar where she'd left the wallet, as well as Denny's restaurant next door. Despite all our security precautions, we were spotted. The next day, the Herald Examiner reported, in addition to winning immunity, Mrs. Kasabian was given a bonus in the form of a Chinese dinner at Madame Wu's Garden Restaurant in Santa Monica. Restaurant employees confirmed Mrs. Kasabian, defense attorney Fleischman, and prosecutor Bugliosi ate there Sunday. The paper neglected to mention that our party included a half dozen LAPD officers and two LASO deputies. We took Linda out twice more, trying to find the two houses in Pasadena. On both occasions, we were accompanied by South Pasadena PD officers who directed us to neighborhoods similar to those Linda had described. We finally found the large house atop the hill. Though I had it and the adjoining houses photographed, they were close together, as Manson had said, I decided against talking to the owners, sure they would sleep better not knowing how close to death they had come. We were never able to locate the first house, which both Susan and Linda had described, where Manson looked in the window and saw the photographs of the children. We did grant Linda one special privilege, which might have been called a bonus. On the three occasions we took her out of Sybil Brand, we let her call her mother in New Hampshire and talk to her two children. Her attorney paid for the calls. Though Angel was only a month old and much too young to understand, just speaking to them obviously meant a great deal to Linda. Yet she never asked to do this. She never asked for anything. She told me not once but several times that although she was pleased to be getting immunity because it meant that eventually she could be with her children, it didn't matter that much if she didn't get it. There was a sort of sad fatalism about her. She said she knew she had to tell the truth about what had happened, and that she had known she would be the one to tell the story ever since the murders occurred. Unlike the other defendants, she seemed burdened with guilt, though, again, unlike them, she hadn't physically harmed anyone. She was a strange girl, marked by her time with Manson, yet not molded by him in the same way the others were. Because she was compliant, easily led, Manson apparently had had little trouble controlling her. Up to a point. But she had refused to cross that point. "I'm not you, Charlie. I can't kill anybody." Once I asked her what she thought about Manson now. She was still in love with him, Linda said. "Some things he said were the truth," she observed thoughtfully. "Only now I realize he could take a truth and make a lie of it." Shortly after the story broke that Linda Kasabian would testify for the prosecution, Al Wyman, the reporter with the Channel 7 crew which had found the clothing, showed up in my office. If Kasabian was cooperating with us, then she must have indicated where she threw the knives, Wyman surmised. He begged me to pinpoint the area. His station, he promised, would supply a search crew, metal detectors, everything. Look, Al, I told him, you guys have already found the clothing. How is it going to look at the trial if you find the knives, too? Tell you what, I'm trying to get someone out. If they won't go, then I'll tell you. After Wyman left, I called McGann. 2 weeks had passed since I'd asked him to look for the knives. He still hadn't done it. My patience at an end, I called Lieutenant Helder and told him about Wyman's offer. Think how LAPD is going to look if it comes out during the trial that a 10-year-old boy found the gun and Channel 7 found both the clothing and the knives. Bob had a crew out the next day. No luck. But at least during the trial we'd be prepared to prove that they had looked. Otherwise, the defense could contend that LAPD was so skeptical of Linda Kasabian's story that they hadn't even bothered to mount a search. That they'd failed to find the knives was a disappointment, but not too much of a surprise. Over 7 months had passed since the night Linda tossed the knives out of the car. According to her testimony, one had bounced back into the road while the other had landed in the bushes nearby. The street, though in the country, was much traveled. It was quite possible they had been picked up by a motorist or passing cyclist. I had no idea how often the police had interviewed Winifred Chapman, the Polanski's maid. I'd talked to her a number of times myself before I realized there was one question so obvious we'd all overlooked it. Mrs. Chapman had stated that she washed the front door of the Tate residence just after noon on Friday, August 8th. This meant Charles Watson had to have left his print there sometime after this. However, there was a second print found at the Tate residence, Patricia Krenwinkel's, located inside the door that led from Sharon Tate's bedroom to the pool. I asked Mrs. Chapman, did you ever wash that door? Yes. How often? A couple of times a week. She had to, she explained, because the guests usually used that door to get to the pool. The big question. Did you wash it the week of the murders, and if so, when? Answer. Tuesday was the last time. I washed it down inside and out with vinegar and water. Under discovery, I was only required to make a note of the conversation and put it in our tubs. However, in fairness to both Fitzgerald and his client, I called Paul and told him, if you're planning on having Krenwinkel testify that she went swimming at the Tate residence a couple of weeks before the murders and left her print at that time, better forget it. Mrs. Chapman is going to testify she washed that door on Tuesday, August 5th. Paul was grateful for the information. Had he based his defense on this premise, Mrs. Chapman's testimony could have been devastating. There was, in such conversations, something assumed, though unstated. Whatever his public posture, I was sure that Fitzgerald knew that his client was guilty, and he knew that I knew it. Though only on rare occasions does a defense attorney slip up and admit this in court, when it comes to in-chambers discussions and private conversations, it's often something else. There were two items of evidence in our files which I did not point out to the defense. I was sure they had already seen them. Both were among the items photocopied for them, but I was hoping they wouldn't realize their importance. One was a traffic ticket, the other an arrest report. Separately, each seemed unimportant. Together, they made a bomb that would demolish Manson's alibi defense. On first learning from Foles that Manson might claim that he was not in the Los Angeles area at the time of the murders, I had asked LaBianca detectives Patchett and Gutierrez to see if they could obtain evidence proving his actual whereabouts on the subject dates. They did an excellent job. Together with information obtained from credit card transactions and interviews, they were able to piece together a timetable of Manson's activities during the week preceding the start of Helter Skelter. On about August 1, 1969, Manson told several family members that he was going to Big Sur to seek out new recruits. He apparently left on the morning of Sunday, August 3rd, as sometime between 7 and 8, he purchased gas at a station in Canoga Park using a stolen credit card. From Canoga Park, he headed north toward Big Sur. At about 4 the next morning, he picked up a young girl, Stephanie Schramm, outside a service station some distance south of Big Sur, probably at Gorda. An attractive 17-year-old, Stephanie was hitchhiking from San Francisco to San Diego, where she was living with her married sister. Manson and Stephanie camped in a nearby canyon that night, probably Salmon or Limekiln Creek, both hippie hangouts, Manson telling her his views on life, love, and death. Manson talked a lot about death, Stephanie would recall, and it frightened her. They took LSD and had sex. Manson was apparently unusually smitten with Stephanie. Usually he'd have sex with a new girl a few times, then move on to a new, young love. Not so with Stephanie. He later told Paul Watkins that Stephanie, who was of German extraction, was the result of 2,000 years of perfect breeding. On August 4th, Manson, still using the stolen credit card, purchased gas at Lucia. Ripping off the place, which bore a large sign reading "Hippies Not Allowed," must have given him a special satisfaction, as he did it again the next day. On the night of the 5th, Manson and Stephanie drove north to a place whose name Stephanie couldn't recall, but which Manson described as a sensitivity camp. It was, he told her, a place where rich people went on weekends to play at being enlightened. He was obviously describing Esalen Institute. Esalen was, at this time, just coming into vogue as a growth center, its seminars including such diverse figures as yogis and psychiatrists, salvationists and Satanists. Obviously, Manson felt Esalen a prime place to espouse his philosophies. It is unknown whether he had been there on prior occasions, those involved in the Institute refusing to even acknowledge his visits there. At 3:07 p.m. July 30, 1969, someone at the Tate residence called the Esalen Institute, Big Sur, California, telephone number 408-667-2335. It was a brief station-to-station call, total charge 95 cents. It is unknown who placed the call or, since the number is that of the switchboard, who was called. Since the call occurred just 6 days before Charles Manson's visit to Esalen, it arouses a certain amount of speculation. A few things are known, however. None of the Tate victims was at Big Sur during the period Manson was there. Abigail Folger had attended seminars at Esalen in the past, and several of her San Francisco friends visited there periodically. It is possible that she was simply trying to locate someone, but this is just a guess. Though both the call and Manson's visit to Esalen remain mysterious, I should perhaps note that, with a single exception, the Hatami-Tate-Manson confrontation on March 23, 1969, I was unable to find a prior link of any kind between any of the Tate-LaBianca victims and their killers. Manson took his guitar and left Stephanie in the van. After a time, she fell asleep. When she awakened the next morning, Manson had already returned. He was in less than a good mood, as later that day, he unexpectedly struck her. Still later, at Barker Ranch, Manson would tell Paul Watkins, to quote Watkins, that while at Big Sur, he had gone to Esalen and played his guitar for a bunch of people who were supposed to be the top people there, and they rejected his music. Some people pretended that they were asleep, and other people were saying, "This is too heavy for me, and I'm not ready for that," and others were saying, "Well, I don't understand it," and some just got up and walked out. Still another rejection by what Manson considered the establishment, this occurring just 3 days before the Tate murders. With his single recruit, Manson left Big Sur on August 6th, making gas purchases that same day at San Luis Obispo in Chatsworth, a few miles from Spawn Ranch. According to Stephanie, they had dinner at the ranch that night, and she met the family for the first time. She felt uncomfortable with them, and learning that Manson shared his favors with the other girls, told him she would stay only if he would promise to remain with her and her alone for 2 weeks. Surprisingly, Manson agreed. They spent that night in the van, parked not far from the ranch, then drove to San Diego the next day to pick up Stephanie's clothes. En route, about 10 miles south of Oceanside on Interstate 5, they were stopped by California Highway Patrol Officer Richard C. Willis. Though pulled over for a mechanical violation, Manson was cited only for having no valid driver's license in his possession. Manson gave his correct name and the ranch address and signed the ticket himself. Officer Willis noted on the ticket that Manson was driving a 1952 cream-colored Ford bakery van, license number K70683. The date was Thursday, August 7th, 1969. The time, 6:15 p.m. The ticket, which Patchett and Gutierrez found, proved Manson was in Southern California the day before the Tate murders. While Stephanie was getting her clothes together, Manson talked to her sister, who was also a Beatles fan. She had the White Album, and Manson told her the Beatles had laid out the whole scene in it. He warned her that the blacks were getting ready to overthrow the whites, and that only those who fled to the desert and hid in the bottomless pit would be safe. As for those who remained in the cities, Manson said, people are going to be slaughtered. They'll be lying on their lawns, dead. Just a little over 24 hours later, his prediction would be fulfilled in all its gory detail at 10,050 Cielo Drive, with a little help from his friends. That night, according to Stephanie, she and Charlie parked somewhere in San Diego and slept next to the van, returning to Spawn Ranch the following day, arriving there about 2 in the afternoon. Stephanie was a bit vague when it came to dates. She thought the day they returned to Spawn Ranch was Friday, August 8th, but she wasn't sure. I anticipated that the defense would make the most of this, but I wasn't concerned, because that second piece of evidence conclusively placed Manson back at the ranch on Friday, August 8th, 1969. According to Linda Kasabian, on the afternoon of August 8th, Manson gave Mary Brunner and Sandra Good a credit card and told them to purchase some items for him. At 4 that afternoon, the two girls were apprehended while driving away from a Sears store in San Fernando after store employees checked and found the credit card was stolen. The San Fernando PD arrest report stated that they were driving a van 1952 Ford license K70683. Because of the fine job of digging by the LaBianca detectives, we now had physical proof that Manson was back at Spawn Ranch on Friday, August 8th, 1969. Though both the traffic ticket and arrest report were in the discovery materials, so were hundreds of other documents. I was hoping that the defense would overlook their common denominator, that vehicle description with its telltale license number. If Manson went with an alibi defense, and I proved that alibi was fabricated, this would be strong, circumstantial evidence of his guilt. There was, of course, other evidence placing Manson at Spawn Ranch that day. In addition to the testimony of Schramm, DiCarlo, and others, Linda Kasabian said that when the family got together that afternoon, Manson discussed his visit to Big Sur, saying that the people there were really not together, they were just off on their little trips, and that the people wouldn't go on his trip. It was just after this that Manson told them, "Now is the time for Helter Skelter." Bits and pieces, often largely circumstantial, yet patiently dug out and assembled, they became the people's case. And with almost every interview, it became a little stronger. I spent many hours interviewing Stephanie Schramm, who, together with Kitty Lutzinger, had fled Barker Ranch just hours before the October 1969 raid, shotgun-wielding Clem in close pursuit. I often wondered what would have happened to the two girls had the raid been timed just a day later, or Clem been a little faster. Unlike Kitty, Stephanie had severed all contact with the family. Though we had kept her current address from the defense, Squeaky and Gypsy found her working at a dog grooming school. "Charlie wants you to come back," they told her. Stephanie replied, "No thanks." Considering what she knew, her forthright refusal was a brave act. From Stephanie, I learned that while at Barker Manson had conducted a murder school, he had given a buck knife to each of the girls and had demonstrated how they should slit the throats of pigs by yanking the head back by the hair and drawing the knife from ear to ear, using Stephanie as a very frightened model. He also said they should stab them in either their ears or eyes and then wiggle the knife around to get as many vital organs as possible. The details became even gorier. Manson said that if the police pigs came to the desert, they should kill them, cut them in little pieces, boil the heads, then put the skulls and uniforms on posts to frighten off others. Much later, I discovered that LASO deputies George Palmer and William Gleason had obtained much of this same information from Stephanie Schramm on December 3, 1969, but LASO had not informed LAPD of this. Stephanie had told LAPD that Manson had spent the nights of Friday, August 8th, and Saturday, August 9th, with her. On questioning her, I learned that about an hour after dinner on August 8th, Manson took her to the trailer at Spawn and told her to go to sleep, that he would join her soon. However, she didn't see him again until shortly before dawn the next morning, at which time he awakened her and took her with him to Devil's Canyon, the camp across the road from the ranch. That night, August 9th, Stephanie said, when it got dark, he left, and he came back either sometime during the night or early in the morning. If Manson was planning on using Stephanie Schramm as an alternative alibi, we were now more than ready for him. On March 19th, Hollow Peter, Manson's court-appointed attorney, made two motions: that Charles Manson be given a psychiatric examination and that his case be severed from that of the others. Enraged, Manson tried to fire Hollow Peter. Asked whom he wished to represent him, Manson replied, "Myself." When Judge Keene denied the change, Manson picked up a copy of the Constitution and, saying it meant nothing to the court, tossed it in a wastebasket. Manson eventually requested that Ronald Hughes be substituted for Hollow Peter. Like Reiner and Shin, Hughes had been one of the first attorneys to call on Manson. He had remained on the periphery of the case ever since, his chief function being to run errands for Manson, as indicated by a document Manson had signed on February 17th, designating him one of his legal runners. Keene granted the substitution. Hollow Peter, whom the press called one of L.A. County's most successful defense attorneys, was out after 13 days. Hughes, who had never before tried a case, was in. Something of an intellectual, Hughes was a huge, balding man with a long, scraggly beard. His various items of apparel rarely matched and usually evidenced numerous food stains. As one reporter remarked, "You could usually tell what Ron had for breakfast for the past several weeks." Hughes, whom I would get to know well in the months ahead, and for whom I developed a growing respect, once admitted to me that he had bought his suits for $1 apiece at MGM. They were from Walter Slezak's old wardrobe. The press was quick to dub him Manson's hippie lawyer. Hughes' first two acts were to withdraw the motions for the psychiatric examination and the severance. Granted. His third and fourth were requests that Manson be allowed to revert to pro per status and to deliver a speech to the court. Denied. Although Manson was displeased with Keene's last two rulings, he couldn't have been too unhappy with the defense team, which now consisted of four attorneys: Reiner, Van Houten, Shin, Atkins, Fitzgerald, Krenwinkle, and Hughes, Manson, each of whom had been associated with him since early in the case. Unknown to us, there were still changes ahead. Among the casualties would be both Ira Reiner and Ronald Hughes, each of whom dared go against Manson's wishes. Reiner would lose considerable time and money for having linked himself with the Manson defense. His loss would be small, however, compared to that of Hughes, who just 8 months later would pay with his life. On March 21st, Aaron and I were walking down the corridor in the Hall of Justice when we spotted Irving Kennerick emerging from the elevator. Although little known elsewhere, Kennerick was something of a legend in the Los Angeles courts. The attorney's obstructionist tactics had caused a number of judges to openly censure him from the bench. Kennerick's stories were so common and usually incredible as to seem fictional when they were actually fact. Prosecutor Burton Katz, for example, recalled that Kennerick once objected to a prosecution witness's stating his own name because, having first heard his name from his mother, it was hearsay. Such frivolous objections were minor irritations compared with Kennerick's dilatory tactics. As samples, in the case of People v. Goodman, Kennerick had stretched a simple theft case, which should have taken a few hours or a day at most to 3 months. The amount stolen, $100. The cost to the taxpayers, $130,212. In the case of People v. Smith and Powell, Kennerick spent 12.5 months on pretrial motions. After an additional 2 months trying to pick a jury, Kennerick's own client fired him in disgust. A year and a half after Irving Kennerick came onto the case, the jury still hadn't been selected, nor a single witness called. In the case of People v. Bronson, Superior Court Judge Raymond Roberts told Kennerick, "I am doing my best to see that Mr. Bronson gets a fair trial in spite of you. I have never seen such obviously stupid, ill-advised questions of a witness. Are you paid by the word or by the hour that you can consume the court's time? You are the most obstructionist man I have ever met." Outside the presence of the jury, Judge Roberts defined Kennerick's modus operandi as follows. "You take interminable lengths of time in cross-examining on the most minute, unimportant details. You ramble back and forth with no chronology of events to just totally confuse everybody in the courtroom to the utter frustration of the jury, the witnesses, and the judge." After examining the transcript, the appellate court found the judge's remarks were not prejudicial, but were substantiated by the trial record. "All we need, Vince," Aaron remarked jocularly to me, "is to have Irving Kennerick on this case. We'd be in court 10 years. The next day, Ronald Hughes told a reporter that he may ask Van Nuys attorney I.A. Kennerick to enter the case as Manson's lawyer. He mentioned that he and Manson conferred with Kennerick at the county jail Monday night. Though no miracle was involved, the Black Panther whom Charles Manson had shot and killed in July 1969 had resurrected. Only he wasn't a panther, just a former dope dealer, and contrary to what Manson and the family had believed, after Manson shot him, he hadn't died, though his friends had told Manson that he had. His name was Bernard Crowe, but he was best known by the descriptive nickname Lotsa Papa. Our long search for Crowe ended when an old acquaintance of mine, Ed Tolmas, who was Crowe's attorney, called me. He told me he had learned we were looking for his client and arranged for me to interview Crowe. After Manson and TJ had left the Hollywood apartment where the shooting took place, Crowe, who had been playing dead, told his friends to call an ambulance. They did, then split. When questioned by the police at the hospital, Crowe said he didn't know who had shot him or why. He nearly didn't make it. He was on the critical list for 18 days. The bullet was still lodged next to his spine. I was interested in Crowe for 2 reasons. One, the incident proved that Charles Manson was quite capable of killing someone on his own. Though I knew I couldn't get this into evidence during the guilt phase of the trial, I was hopeful of introducing it during the penalty phase, when other crimes can be considered. Two, from the description, it appeared that the gun Manson had shot Crowe with was the same .22-caliber Longhorn revolver which, just a little over a month later, Tex Watson would use in the Tate homicides. If we could remove the bullet from Crowe's body and match it up with the bullets test-fired from the .22-caliber revolver, we'd have placed the Tate murder weapon in Manson's own hand. Sergeant Bill Lee of SID wasn't optimistic about the bullet. He told me that since it had been embedded in the body for over 9 months, it was likely that acids had obliterated the stria to an extent where a positive identification would be difficult. Still, it might be possible. I then talked to several surgeons. They could take out the bullet, they told me, but the operation was risky. I laid it out for Crow. We'd like to have the bullet and would arrange to have it removed at the Los Angeles County Hospital, but there were serious risks involved, and I didn't minimize them. Crow declined the operation. He was sort of proud of the bullet, he said. It made quite a conversation piece. Eventually, Manson would have learned through discovery of the resurrection of Bernard Crow. Before this, however, Crow was jailed on a marijuana charge. As he was being escorted down the hall, he passed Manson and his guard, who were on their way back from the attorney room. Charlie did a quick about-face, then told Crow, according to the deputies who were present, "Sorry I had to do it, but you know how it is." Crow's response, if there was one, went unreported. Toward the end of March, the prosecution nearly lost one of its key witnesses. Paul Watkins, once Manson's chief lieutenant, was pulled out of a flaming Volkswagen camper and rushed to Los Angeles County General Hospital with second-degree burns on 25% of his face, arms, and back. When sufficiently recovered to talk to the police, Watkins told them he had fallen asleep while reading by candlelight, and either that or a marijuana cigarette he had been smoking could have caused the fire. These were only guesses, Watkins told them, as he was unsure of the origin of the blaze. 3 days before the fire, Inyo County authorities had heard a rumor that Watkins was going to be killed by the family. As far back as November 1969, I'd asked LAPD to infiltrate the family. I not only wanted to know what they were planning as far as defense strategy was concerned, I told the officers it would be tragic if there was another murder which we could have prevented. I made this request at least 10 times, LAPD finally contending that if they did plant an undercover agent in the family, he would have to commit crimes, for example, smoke marijuana. For there to be a crime, I noted, there had to be criminal intent. If he was doing it as part of his job to catch a criminal, it wouldn't be a crime. When they balked at this, I said he didn't even have to be a police officer. If they had paid informers in narcotics, bookmaking, even prostitution cases, surely they could manage to come up with one in one of the biggest murder cases of our time. No dice. Finally, I turned to the DA's Bureau of Investigation, and they found a young man willing to accept the assignment. I admired his determination, but he was clean-cut, with short hair, and looked as straight as they come. As desperate as we were for information, I couldn't send him into that den of killers. Once they stopped laughing, they'd chop him to pieces. Eventually, I had to abandon the idea. We remained in the dark as to what the family was planning to do next. April 1970. The words pig, death to pigs, rise, and helter-skelter contain only 13 different letters. Handwriting experts told me it would be extremely difficult, if not impossible, to match the bloody words found at the Tate and LaBianca residences with printing exemplars obtained from the defendants. It wasn't only the small number of letters involved. The words were printed, not written. The letters were oversized. In both cases, unusual writing implements had been used, a towel at the Tate residence, probably a rolled-up piece of paper at the LaBiancas. And all but the two words found on the refrigerator door at the latter residence had been printed high up on the walls, the person responsible having to stretch unnaturally high to make them. As evidence, they appeared worthless. However, thinking about the problem, I came up with an idea which, if successful, could convert them into very meaningful evidence. It was a gamble, but if it worked, it would be worth it. We knew who had printed the words. Susan Atkins had testified before the grand jury that she had printed the word pig on the front door of the Tate house, while Susan had told me when I interviewed her that Patricia Krenwinkel had admitted printing the words at the LaBiancas. Though Susan's grand jury testimony and her statements to me were inadmissible because of the deal we had made with her, she had confessed the printing at Tate to Ronnie Howard, so we had her on that. But we had nothing admissible on Krenwinkel. The Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution provides that no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that this is limited to verbal utterances, and that a defendant cannot refuse to give physical evidence of himself, like appearing in a lineup, submitting to a breath analysis test for drunken driving, giving fingerprint and handwriting exemplars, hair samples, and so on. After researching the law, I drew up very explicit instructions for Captain Carpenter at Sybil Brand, stating exactly how to request the printing exemplars of Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Leslie Van Houten. Each was to be informed, 1. You have no constitutional right to refuse. 2. You have no constitutional right to have your attorney present. 3. Your constitutional right to remain silent does not include the right to withhold printing exemplars. And 4, if you submit to this process, this can be used as evidence by the prosecution in your case. Captain Carpenter assigned Senior Deputy H.L. Mouse to obtain the exemplars. According to my instructions, she informed Susan Atkins of the above, then told her, "The word pig was printed in blood at the Tate residence. We want you to print the word pig." Susan, without complaint, printed the exemplar as requested. Leslie Van Houten and Patricia Krenwinkel were brought in individually and given similar instructions concerning their rights. However, each was told orally, "The words helter-skelter, death to pigs, and rise were printed in blood at the LaBianca residence. We want you to print those words." In my memo to Captain Carpenter, there was one additional instruction for the deputy. Do not write any of this for them. I wanted to see if Krenwinkel misspelled helter as heelter, as she had on the refrigerator door. Leslie Van Houten printed the exemplar. Patricia Krenwinkel refused. We'd won the gamble. We could now use her refusal in the trial as circumstantial evidence of her guilt. As evidence, this was doubly important, since before this I'd had absolutely no independent evidence corroborating Linda Kasabian's testimony regarding Patricia Krenwinkel's involvement in the LaBianca murders. And without corroborating evidence as a matter of law, Krenwinkel would have been entitled to an acquittal on those charges. Though we'd won that gamble, Krenwinkel herself could just as easily have emerged the winner. Leslie could have refused to make an exemplar also, which would have diluted the force of Katie's refusal. Or Katie could have made the exemplar, the handwriting experts then failing to match her printing with that found at the LaBiancas. We were less lucky when it came to putting the Tate Sebring rope and the wire cutters in Manson's possession before the murders, evidence I was counting on to provide the necessary corroboration of Linda Kasabian's testimony as to Manson. We knew from DiCarlo, who had been present, that Manson had purchased about 200 feet of the white three-strand nylon rope at the Jack Frost surplus store in Santa Monica in June 1969. However, when Tate detectives finally interviewed Frost, 3.5 months after my initial request, he was unable to find a purchase order for the rope. Nor could he definitely state that this was the same rope he had stocked. Frost recalled stocking some three-strand white nylon rope, but he believed it was 1/2 inch thick. The Tate Sebring rope was 5/8 inch thick. While it was possible that Frost had been mistaken or the rope had been mislabeled, the defense could argue that it simply wasn't the same rope. An attempt to identify the manufacturer, then trace it back to Frost, also failed. Frost usually picked up his stock in odd lots from jobbers or through auctions, rather than directly from the manufacturer. Just as these were blind alleys, so was one other. Literally. According to DiCarlo, Manson had given part of the rope to George Spahn for use on the ranch. Spahn's near-blindness, however, eliminated him as a witness. It was then I thought of Ruby Pearl. For some reason, though the police had visited Spahn Ranch numerous times, none of the officers had interviewed Ruby, George's ranch manager. I found her a fund of valuable information. Examining the Tate Sebring rope, she not only said it looked like the rope Manson had, she also supplied numerous examples of Manson's domination. Recalled seeing the .22 Longhorn at the ranch many times, identified the leather thong found at the LaBiancas as similar to the ones Manson often wore, and told me that prior to the arrival of the family at Spahn, she had never seen any buck knives there, but that in the summer of 1969, suddenly it seemed everyone had one. While disappointed that we couldn't obtain documented proof of the rope sale, I was pleased with Ruby. Being an experienced horse wrangler, as well as a tough, gallant lady who showed not the slightest fear of the family, her testimony would carry weight. There was a fine streak of stubborn authority about her. When Manson was brought to Los Angeles from Independence, Ruby Pearl visited him at the jail. "I only came here for one reason, Charlie," she told him. "I want to know where Shorty was buried." Manson, unwilling to meet her gaze, looked down at the floor and remarked, "Ask the Black Panthers." "Charlie, you know the Black Panthers have never been up to the ranch," she responded, turning her back on him and walking out. Another find was Randy Starr, whom I interviewed the same day as Ruby. A sometime movie stuntman who specialized in fake hangings, Starr said the Tate Sebring rope was identical to a rope he'd once used to help Manson pull a vehicle out of the creek bed. Starr told me Manson always kept the rope behind the seat in his dune buggy. Even more important was Randy Starr's positive identification of the .22 Longhorn revolver, for Starr had once owned the gun and had given it to Manson. The gun, serial number 1902708, had been among a number of weapons taken from the archery headquarters in El Monte, California, during a burglary on the night of March 12, 1969. According to Starr, he obtained it in a trade with a man known only as Ron. Manson was always borrowing the gun for target practice, and Randy finally gave it to him in trade for a truck that had belonged to Danny DiCarlo. One question remained unanswered. Why on the night of the Tate murders did the killers bring along 43 feet 8 inches of rope? To tie up the victims? Manson accomplished this the next night with a single leather thong. I obtained a glimpse of a possible answer during one of my interviews with DiCarlo. According to Danny, in late July of 1969, Manson had told him that the establishment pigs ought to have their throats cut and be hung up by their feet. This would really throw the fear into people, Manson said. The logical inference, I felt, was that the killers brought along the rope intending to hang their victims. It was only a guess, but I suspected it was correct. The wire cutters presented their own problems. Linda Kasabian said the pair found in Manson's dune buggy looked like the pair that had been in the car that night. Fine. Joe Granato of SID used them to test cut a section of the Tate telephone wire and concluded that the two cuts were the same. Great. But then Officer Dwayne Wolfer, considered LAPD's foremost expert on physical evidence, made some test cuts also, and he concluded that these wire cutters couldn't have been the ones used. Not about to give up, I asked Wolfer if the tautness of the wire could have been a factor. Possibly, he said. I then asked Wolfer to accompany telephone company representatives to 10,050 Cielo Drive and make another cut, only this time I wanted him to sever the wire while it was strung up and tight, the way it was the night of the murders. Wolfer eventually made the test, but his opinion remained unchanged. The actual cut made on the night of the murders and the test cut did not match. While it was possible that the cutting edge of the wire cutters could have been damaged subsequent to the Tate murders, Wolfer's tests literally severed this important link between Manson and the Tate evidence. When I'd accompanied